My name is Michael McCusker. Well, a couple of days ago, a friend expressed his opinion that global warming was a hoax and that it was a conspiracy to establish a world government. I was unaware he felt that way and was too flummoxed to offer persuasive argument. I was able to only respond with mealy-mouthed platitudes that he should not so ardently believe entirely any one side of an argument, that the closer you think you are at the truth, the more elusive it seems. Stephen Colbert's truthiness comes to mind, and the more you attempt to discover facts, the greater the prospects of blundering among factoids. Later that same day, somewhat serendipitously, I received the latest issue of Rolling Stone in the mail, and blasting like an explosion from the magazine's cover, which was starkly black, the bold red banner, "You Idiots," with a sub-banner, "Meet the Planet's Worst Enemies." Truly a clarion call, and certainly a response to my friend to whom I dedicate this morning's reading of the enclosed article, "As the World Burns," by Jeff Goodell. I have had to abridge it to fit into this half hour, but the full article can be found in the January 21st, 2010 issue of Rolling Stone, and quite conceivably online. As the World Burns, how Big Oil and Big Coal mounted one of the most aggressive lobbying campaigns in history to block progress on global warming, by Jeff Goodell. This was supposed to be the transformative moment on global warming, the tipping point when America proved to the world that capitalism has a conscience, that we take the fate of the planet seriously. According to the script, Congress would pass a landmark bill committing the United States to deep cuts in carbon emissions. President Obama would then arrive in Copenhagen for the International Climate Summit, armed with the moral and political capital he needed to challenge the rest of the world to do the same. After all, wasn't this the kind of bold move the Norwegians were anticipating when they awarded Obama the Nobel Peace Prize? As we now know, it didn't work out that way. Obama arrived in Copenhagen last month without any legislation committing the U.S. to reduce carbon pollution. Instead of reaching agreement on how to stop cooking the planet, the summit devolved into bickering over who bears the most blame for turning up the heat. The world once again missed an opportunity to avert disaster, and the delay is likely to have deadly consequences. In recent years, we have moved from talking about the possibility of climate change to watching it unfold before our eyes. The Arctic is melting. Wildfires are turning into infernos. Warm weather insects are devouring forests. Droughts are getting longer and more lethal. And the more we learn about climate change, the more it becomes apparent how enormous the risks are. Just a few years ago, researchers estimated that sea levels would likely rise 17 inches by 2100. Now they believe it could be 3 feet or more, a cataclysmic shift that would doom many of the world's cities, including London and New Orleans, and create tens of millions of climate refugees. Our collective response to the emerging catastrophe verges on suicidal. World leaders have been talking about tackling climate change for nearly 20 years now, yet carbon emissions keep going up and up. "We are in a race against time," says Representative Jay Inslee, a Democrat from Washington, who has fought for sharp reductions in planet-warming pollution. "Mother Nature isn't sitting around waiting for us to get our political act together," he said. In fact, our failure to confront global warming is more than simply political incompetence. Over the past year, the corporations and special interests most responsible for climate change waged an all-out war to prevent Congress from cracking down on carbon pollution in time for Copenhagen. The oil and coal industries deployed an unprecedented army of lobbyists, spent millions on misleading studies, and engaged in outright deception to derail climate legislation. "It was the most aggressive and corrupt lobbying campaign I've ever seen," says Paula Begala, a veteran Democratic consultant. By preventing meaningful action in Copenhagen, the battle to kill the climate bill provided the world's biggest polluters with a lucrative victory, one that comes at the rest of the world's expense. In the long term, the fossil fuel industry is going to lose this war, says Kevin Knobloch, I guess that's how you pronounce his name, president of the Union of Concerned Scientists. But, he says, in the short term, they are doing everything they can to delay the revolution. For them, what this fight is really about is buying precious time to maximize profits from carbon sources. It's really no more complicated than that. For the nation's dirtiest carbon polluters, the election of President Obama was not good news. Big energy interests had a real pal in George W. Bush. But during the 2008 campaign, Obama put the fate of the planet above the fate of fossil fuel industry. America's oil addiction, he declared, is, quote, one of the greatest challenges of our generation, unquote. Even before the election was over, those who had the candidate's ear were urging Obama to move quickly to enact climate legislation. In a lengthy memo to the campaign, an experienced veteran of the climate wars advised that the incoming president would, quote, be able to claim a mandate to lead boldly, unquote, on carbon pollution. The memo recommended that Obama take immediate steps to design a plan of attack by setting up a SWAT team of key advisors and congressional leaders. The president must seize the debate, the memo warned, before others hijack or derail it. Obama's first moves on the climate front were encouraging. He appointed Carol Browner, head of the EPA under Bill Clinton and a close confidant of Al Gore, as climate czar. And he named Stephen Chu, a respected scientist who understood the need to confront global warming, as energy secretary. A month after taking office, he also moved to implement a 2007 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court empowering the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant. The threat to big coal and big oil was implicit. If energy interests balked at working with Congress to create a new system to curb carbon pollution, the administration would simply unleash federal regulators. If Congress does nothing, warned Senator Barbara Boxer, who was spearheading climate legislation as chair of the Senate Environment Committee, we will be watching EPA do our job. Obama also had something else going for him. The man he had defeated for president was one of the chief backers of a bipartisan plan to rein in climate warming pollution. It was widely assumed that John McCain, who had co-sponsored a plan known as Cap and Trade with Democrat Joe Lieberman back in 2003, would be a crucial ally in selling tough, effective carbon limits to his GOP colleagues in the Senate. At root, cap and trade is a fairly simple idea. The government sets an economy-wide cap on carbon dioxide emissions by issuing a fixed number of permits for carbon pollution each year. Those permits can then be traded on the open market, enabling polluters to decide for themselves whether it's cheaper to cut emissions or buy permits. The same approach worked spectacularly well in curbing acid rain 2 decades ago, reducing sulfur dioxide pollution far faster and cheaper than anyone had anticipated. Celebrated as one of the great success stories of the environmental movement, the program has spawned a number of imitators, including a European market for carbon emissions that got underway in 2005, as well as a statewide carbon trading system under development in California. That's not to say there aren't problems with cap and trade. Tracking CO2 from millions of sources poses a daunting challenge, and granting too many loopholes known as carbon offsets could render the entire system meaningless. But the plan enjoyed wide support among environmentalists, economists, and business leaders as the fastest, cheapest, and most politically viable way to cut climate warming pollution. The most important thing, Chu said last spring, is to get the architecture in place and to begin to move in a new direction. Any plans Obama had to move quickly on climate legislation, however, were derailed by the economic disaster he inherited from the Bush administration. As the new president scrambled to bail out Wall Street to keep GM afloat and win approval for a $787 billion plan to stimulate the economy, including $80 billion for clean energy and green jobs, reining in carbon pollution dropped lower and lower on the list of pressing demands. In the midst of the worst recession in a generation, says Jason Grummet, who served as Obama's top energy advisor during the campaign, climate change isn't what leaps to mind for the average voter. When it came time to set his legislative agenda, Obama decided to make health care rather than global warming his top priority. Health care has a populist feel to it, explains a campaign insider. It's much more the kind of meat and potatoes issue that Obama feels comfortable with. The decision to put healthcare first infuriated some activists who feared the president would be unable to win climate legislation in time for Copenhagen. Why not push a climate bill as green stimulus part two, says one top environmental economist. But leaders in the House had already decided to push through a climate bill on their own, even without strong public support from the White House. Taking the lead on the measure was Representative Henry Waxman, chairman of the powerful House Energy and Commerce Committee, and Representative Ed Markey, head of the House Select Committee for Energy Independence and Global Warming. As one climate activist close to the administration steamed, what good is health care on a dead planet? Waxman's and Markey's bill, the American Clean Energy and Security Act, was hardly a silver bullet aimed at the heart of big coal and big oil. It set a wimpy near-term goals for reducing carbon, only 20% by 2020, and included far too many offsets, 2 billion tons a year. All in all, it was nowhere near as tough as it needed to be to cut emissions quickly and stave off the most extreme consequences of climate change. But it did contain strong measures to improve energy efficiency, and it represented a crucial first step in creating the framework for a low-carbon economy. The legislation now on the table isn't the bill we ideally want, but it's the bill we can get, and it's vastly better than no bill at all, observed Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize laureate. If the bill pulled its punches on global warming, that's because it was based in large part on a business-friendly blueprint that had been laid out in January, only a few days before Obama was sworn in as president. Assembled by the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, a coalition of leading environmental groups and major companies like GE and ConocoPhillips, the plan called for reducing carbon pollution by as little as 14% before 2020, while continuing to allow conventional coal plants to be built. The industry-driven plan prompted the National Wildlife Federation to pull out of USCAP, calling for action that measures up to what scientists say is needed, quote-unquote. Still, and even in its diluted form, the House bill alarmed many coal and oil companies. Foreseeing a showdown over climate change, the energy industry had been busy packing Capitol Hill with lobbyists. By last year, according to the Center for Public Integrity, the number of lobbyists devoted to climate change had soared by more than fivefold since 2003 to a total of 2,810, or five lobbyists for every lawmaker in Washington. I had no idea this many lobbyists even existed in Washington, says former Senator Tim Wirth, now head of the United Nations Foundation. Only 138 of the lobbyists were pushing for alternative energy. The rest were heavily weighted toward the old fossil fuel mafia, most of whom opposed tough carbon caps. The most aggressive foes were coal polluters like Peabody Energy and the Southern Company, an Atlanta-based utility known for its prowess on Capitol Hill. They're kneecap breakers, says one congressional staffer. For Southern and Peabody, as well as for oil giants like ExxonMobil, the Waxman-Markey bill meant war. If they could kill it, they could not only stall action on climate at home, they could also wreck the chances for an international deal in Copenhagen. These companies had spent decades funding studies that undermined the science of global warming, using tactics honed by the tobacco industry to sow doubt and confusion in hopes of staving off regulation. Now they switched their line of attack. Rather than arguing that global warming isn't real, they tried to shift the fear from climate change to the specter of a massive government intervention. The climate bill, they argued, was nothing more than a national energy tax that would cause energy prices to skyrocket and destroy American jobs. As evidence, they pointed to a study by the Heritage Foundation, long a purveyor of junk science favored by the energy industry. The conservative think tank has received at least $500,000 from ExxonMobil and $3 million from funders with ties to Koch Industries, a major oil refining company. Not surprisingly, the Heritage study predicted economic disaster if the climate bill were signed into law. Electricity rates would jump by 90%. Gas prices would increase by 74%. The average energy bill would rise by $1,500 a year, and as many as 2.5 million jobs would disappear. This, of course, was complete bear malarkey. The most credible analysis of the bill from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office found that the measure would cost most families no more than $175 a year, the equivalent of about a postage stamp a day, Markey says. But the Heritage Foundation is nothing if not a big, well-greased disinformation machine. We noticed that every time a constituent came in to talk to us about the bill, they would be quoting the same numbers, says one congressional staffer. We knew they were a lie, but they were everywhere. Energy lobbyists found a willing ally in the Republican Party, which had decided to deny any legislative victory to President Obama, even if it meant cooking the planet in the process. Representative Joe Barton, a Republican from Texas, who had been replaced by Waxman as chair of the House Energy Committee, pledged to launch, quote, crafty, unquote, attacks on the climate bill, comparing the GOP's battle to guerrilla warfare. A key element to the crafty tactics employed by the Republicans involved a simple approach, lying. Cap and trade, they argued, should really be called cap and tax. Throughout the debate, GOP members of the House cited a study by MIT that, they claimed, showed the climate bill would, quote, cost every American family up to $3,100 per year in higher energy prices. John Riley, an MIT professor and one of the authors of the study, called House Republicans and protested that they were distorting his findings. But a week later, House Minority Leader John Boehner used the $3,100 figure again, and the National Republican Congressional Committee employed it in dozens of press releases. Riley sent a blunt letter to Boehner, and Markey's committee, noting that $3,100 was actually, quote, 10 times the correct estimate, which is approximately $340. But deception wasn't the only card that House Republicans had to play. As the climate bill moved through Waxman's committee, Barton and his troops fell back on tactical games to stall the measure. Before the committee voted, Barton threatened to have the entire 900-plus page bill read aloud, hoping that Democrats would get sick of the delay and simply walk out. When Barton discovered that the committee had brought in a speed reader to tear through the bill, he relented. But as the ranking Republican on the committee, he tied up the process by introducing 400 amendments designed to weaken or stall the bill. By the time the measure came to a vote last June, however, it had become clear that Barton and his fellow Republicans weren't the only ones listening to lobbyists from the energy industry. For the Democrats, passing the climate bill came down to a simple equation: how many favors they were prepared to shovel out to the Republicans in the coal industry. Without support from Democrats in key energy states, the bill didn't stand a chance. Waxman and Markey, both of whom had recently backed what amounted to a moratorium on new coal-fired plants, were hardly friends of the industry. But now they were willing to cut a deal, and so was Big Coal. Instituting a system to curb carbon pollution, the industry knew, would reveal coal for what it is, the nation's single biggest contributor to global warming and a source of air pollution that kills 24,000 people each year. To shift the focus of the debate, the industry launched an all-out effort to rebrand its product, spending $18 million on a high-profile ad campaign to sell Americans on the virtues of clean coal. The campaign, paid for by the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, ACCCE, a front group for coal companies and utilities, was vague about how coal could actually be cleaned up, relying instead on images of hip hardware like Mac computers to suggest that technology could somehow solve the problem. What the ads failed to note was that the technology behind clean coal, known as carbon capture and sequestration, is still a pipe dream. There is not a single commercial coal-fired power plant in the world that captures and buries its carbon emissions for a very simple reason. The process is far too complicated and expensive. But the coal industry knew it didn't need to have a real solution. It could just tout the promise of new technology without actually changing a thing. To drive home its message on Capitol Hill, the coal industry spent $10 million lobbying, far more than any other special interest devoted to climate change. And to make sure congressmen were paying attention, ACCE's member firms and their employees, including top executives, contributed more than $15 million to federal campaigns. The polluter-friendly measures won the support of some big coal burners, including American Electric Power, the nation's dirtiest utility. But even with all the handouts, the industry's most conservative factions continued to oppose the climate bill. In the final hours, the lobbying went into overdrive. ACCCE spent $540,000 on what turned out to be a fraudulent grassroots campaign, using a Washington consultant called Bonner & Associates to bombard undecided congressmen with fake letters, supposedly from the NAACP, demanding that they vote against the climate bill. The blatant deception and the use of forged documents was not discovered until after the vote. It was old tobacco tactics, pure and simple, Representative Inslee says. By that point, the months of backroom deal-making had succeeded in diluting the climate bill and loading it up with tax breaks and subsidies for industry. By the time it came to the floor on June 26th, the measure clocked in at more than 1,400 pages. The all-important target for reducing carbon pollution by 2020 had been cut from 20% to 17%. The goals for boosting renewable energy were cut nearly in half. The EPA's authority to regulate carbon emissions had been gutted, and instead of auctioning off all pollution permits, as Obama had promised during the campaign, the bill gave 83% of them away for free, up to half of them in the near term to industrial polluters. According to an analysis by Stanford University economists, polluters received $134 billion in allowances that weren't necessary to ensure America's industrial stability. The nation's dirtiest corporations, the ones most responsible for global warming, had just been given a huge government handout. Still, even with all its flaws, the climate measure was the first bill Congress had ever seriously considered that placed a comprehensive cap on carbon pollution. And if the bill failed, it might be years before supporters had another shot. We didn't make a single compromise we didn't have to get the bill passed, Markey says. With the help of President Obama, who met with undecided members, the climate bill squeaked through the House by a vote of 219 to 212. Even with the president's efforts, 44 Democrats voted against the measure. Markey believes the legislation will ultimately be seen as groundbreaking. In 100 years, we'll look back on this moment and realize that 2009 was the year the United States finally decided to take the problems on our planet seriously. And with all its industry giveaways, the bill should have appeased opponents. Waxman, who has a reputation as a pragmatic deal cutter, notes that the measure represents a broad diversity of concerns and points of view, quote unquote. But even in its watered-down form, the climate bill drew fierce attacks from Republicans. The 8 GOP congressmen who voted for the measure were labeled cap and traitors by party loyalists, and several were told they will face primary challenges next year. The National Republican Congressional Committee also ran ads targeting a dozen or so vulnerable Democrats who supported the bill. The ads, foreshadowing the fight to come during this year's midterm elections, accused the senators of voting, or the congressmen, pardon me, of voting for the Pelosi energy tax, falsely claiming that the climate bill would raise energy costs for his constituents by $1,870 per family. The truth is, the climate bill's passage caught the White House off guard. There was no strategy in place to advance the bill through the Senate, no plans for a primetime address from the president on the urgency of confronting climate change. The White House wasn't the only one scrambling to regroup. The energy industry and its Republican allies realized that their scare tactics on climate change weren't working. To crank up the opposition, they needed to crank up the fear. To do that, they adopted both the rhetoric and the infrastructure of the burgeoning Tea Party movement that had been formed to fight health care reform. Cap and trade, the Republicans began to argue, was part of Obama's master plan. Pardon me while I jump a couple of pages to its continued on. To strip Americans of their freedom. The government is going to monitor where you get your thermostat, how much plane travel you do, declared Mark Morano, a former Republican staffer on the Senate Environment Committee who now runs the Climate Depot, a clearinghouse for disinformation about global warming. It's a level of control we've never even contemplated in America, quote unquote. Never mind that cap and trade would cut climate pollution by harnessing the power of the free market, the virtues of which Republicans have been preaching for decades. The climate bill and its market-based solution was now transformed into an instrument of government control and communist bureaucracy. They're going to take our financial systems, and then they're going to nationalize industry, and then they are going to nationalize energy, Glenn Beck said. Those who support the measure, he added, have exposed themselves quite honestly, I think, as treasonous. The trouble was, people weren't buying such nonsense. Polls show that only 1 in 3 Americans believe that addressing global warming will hurt the economy, and 3 in 4 support some kind of climate legislation. To create the illusion that ordinary voters oppose action on global warming, Big Oil once again relied on outright deception. Last summer, the American Petroleum Institute, the lobbying arm of the oil and gas industry, coordinated a series of energy citizen, and that's a quote, rallies in 20 states to protest limits on carbon pollution. In an internal memo leaked in August, API urged its nearly 400 member companies, including oil giants like Shell and Exxon, to quietly pack the rallies with their own employees. Please treat this information as sensitive, the memo warned. We don't want critics to know our game plan. While the big oil and big coal worked to whip up public hysteria, their Republican allies moved to block the climate bill in the Senate. The most unexpected and influential voice proved to be John McCain, who had long been a champion of climate legislation. The Arizona senator was highly respected by environmental and business leaders for his grasp of both the science and economics of global warming. Even while he was busy selling his soul to the far right during the presidential campaign, he called climate change, quote, a test of foresight, of political courage, of the unselfish concern that one generation owes to the next. But when the opportunity to show some political courage of his own arrived, McCain executed a bizarre about-face. The industry-friendly bill passed by the House, he now declared, a measure modeled on the cap-and-trade bill he had co-sponsored with Joe Lieberman, was, quote, the worst example of legislation I've seen in a long time, unquote. As they had in the House, Republicans in the Senate decided to obstruct the climate bill at every turn. Leading the charge was Senator James Inhofe, the former chair of the Senate Environment Committee, who has not let the fact that the Arctic is melting before our very eyes stop him from continuing to proclaim that global warming is a hoax, and that's a quote. When Boxer, Barbara Boxer, the committee's new chair, tried to advance the climate bill, Inhofe launched a number of procedural maneuvers designed to stall the bill, such as calling for more analysis from the EPA. We all knew it was a game, says one Senate staffer. When Boxer finally forced a vote on the bill in November, Inhofe and his fellow Republicans on the committee didn't even bother to show up. The Senate's failure to act helped torpedo the talks in Copenhagen, which not only failed to produce a binding treaty, but postponed meaningful action until 2015. It has also left Obama with no clear strategy of how to move forward. We're staring into the abyss, says Dan Dudick, chief economist for the Environmental Defense Fund. The best hope is that Democrats manage to pass a climate bill this spring, paving the way for an international treaty that will cut carbon pollution before rising sea levels engulf low-lying nations. It's really about getting people to focus on fact and not fiction, says Senator John Kerry, who will play a key role in guiding legislation through the Senate. As long as we can argue this on real science, not on phony numbers trumped up to scare people, I believe we can get to the place where people realize that curbing climate change will strengthen America's economy and enhance our security. And that was John Kerry. Maybe so. But the most disturbing achievement of the energy industry in the battle over global warming is its success in lowering our expectations. Climate activists like to talk about mobilizing all of America's resources, as we did during World War II, to fight global warming. But as the failure to pass the climate bill reveals, it may be easier to defeat a dictator like Hitler than to overcome internal threats to our future as powerful as big coal and big oil. Despite the near certainty of a climate catastrophe, there are no crowds marching in the streets to demand action, no primetime speech from President Obama. Even the most aggressive climate legislation the Senate might pass, something on par with the House bill, will still fall tragically short of what climate scientists tell us needs to be done to avoid the looming chaos and destruction. In that sense, the only one that ultimately matters, the battle over global warming, may already be over. Thank you.